is United States v. Seal, number 0760732. Ms. Nestor.
May it please the court. Good morning. The clerk has asked me to remind the court that I am one of those who chose to waive my privilege to argue without question, so whenever the court's prepared, please feel free to interrupt me. The panel in this case was correct when they concluded that the vast majority of civil and criminal law in this circuit and other circuits clearly supports retroactive application of congressional changes to statutes of limitations. In 1972, Congress made clear their intent that the kidnapping offense was no longer to be a capital offense. This effectively changed the statute of limitations, which, as we all know, is a separate statute, wholly procedural in nature, but it is inimically connected to whether or not a crime is capital or non-capital. So by making this change, Congress effectively changed the statute of limitations without making a direct amendment to the statute. The case of Goodyear versus Miller from the United States Supreme Court says that Congress is presumed to know the effect of their own decisions on statutes and how it will implicate other laws that are connected with it. It cannot be disputed that the statute of limitations is a purely procedural statute. It furthermore can't be disputed that a change in a basic offense from capital to non-capital effectively changes its statute of limitations. The case of U.S. versus Vanilla, which is a Fifth Circuit case in 1980, held as far back as 1980 that it's well established that procedural changes apply retroactively. In the case of United States versus Provenzano, which the panel felt particularly...
That's a broad overstatement that's not necessarily true. I mean, if you look at the Griffon case, that makes it pretty clear that in this case, you had three substantive changes, only one change that arguably is procedural, which I'm not at all sure that it is, and you had a primarily substantive amendment. So how do you get around Griffon?
I welcome the opportunity to discuss Griffon. Griffon is really the only response that the government seems to have to the panel's analysis of retroactive application. And there are several reasons why Griffon does not control in this case. Just to basically review the nutshell facts of Griffon, Griffon involved a new statute that contained a great deal of substantive and procedural changes, and it was the Civil Monetary Penalties Act, or I can't remember the last word of it is. But what happened was when this new statute came into being, it contained both substantive and procedural portions of the statute. The administrator that was enforcing this new statute tried to sever a portion of it and apply a portion of it retroactively. What the court held in Griffon was when you have a bundle of laws that come down together, you can't pick and choose which parts you apply retroactively and which parts you don't apply retroactively without some guidance from Congress.
My question would be then how do you justify in this case you're doing the same thing that you say Griffon precludes, and that you are picking one amendment and saying that it should be severed from the three substantive amendments of the 1972 amendment?
Actually, I'm not doing that, Your Honor. What we have is an amendment to Section 1201. It does not at all separate the effect on the procedure statute of limitations procedural statute. So we're not severing a law at all. There were no amendments made to the statute of limitations.
I thought Griffon spoke of whether a crime is retroactive or not. And what you're trying to do here is make part of the statute retroactive and part of it prospective.
No, sir, because we're not actually taking a portion of the amendment, the 1972 Act, and applying it backwards, because what happened is the 1972 Act only dealt with the underlying offense of 1201. That's the only thing it amended. By that amendment, by removing the death penalty language, it triggered a wholly separate procedural statute that can be applied without the same concerns that existed in Griffin retroactively. And the I'm sorry.
Ms. Nestor,
look, yes, sir.
Yeah, to me, that's the major question. What do we do with 109? It seems to me that you have to look at the statute that's been amended. And this is a substantive statute that was amended. It wasn't the statute of limitations. Then you have to go to 109 to see the effect it may have, either prospective or retrospective. And it seems to me that if you just focus on the statute, then the substantive changes can only be applied prospective, not retrospective, including the death penalty in this particular case. And then you have to go, it seems to me logically, go to the next step. How does it affect the statute of limitations? Now, obviously, we have other problems because of cases. But it seems to me that's the way that you have to proceed to analyze the statute. Do you agree?
Yes, sir. I'd like to address that. This court and the panel did an excellent analysis on how to analyze whether or not the savings clause applies. And it's really a two-step analysis. First of all, you look at the Blue Seal finding where you make a determination if there's been a substantive or procedural change, and then you apply the Marrero test, which I'll get to in just a moment. But under the substantive versus procedural question, the substantive amendment that relates to all of us here today that they made was the elimination of the death penalty language. Actually, that was simply codifying what the Supreme Court had already done in United States versus Jackson.
But let's talk about that.
Yes, sir.
I am not sure what a case law does necessarily to the implication of the statute of changing the statute of limitations. And I haven't seen any case law where to tell me what the effect may be on the statute of limitations.
Well, here's the main gist of that as I read the case law. The point of the savings clause is if you have a substantive right that you can't merely extinguish it if Congress changes its mind down the road. The problem is there was no substantive right to seek the death penalty because it had already been removed by the Supreme Court when they found it facially void and unconstitutional. So in actuality, at the time they eliminated the death penalty language.
If there was no substantive right of Congress, I guess you were talking about.
Of the government, Your Honor.
Of the government to seek the death penalty or to advance the death penalty, why did the Justice Department recommend that the death penalty be reinstituted without the deficient procedural failings of 1201 earlier?
You know, and they could have done that, which makes it even more compelling what their intent was, which was to completely change kidnapping to a non-capital crime.
Well, I mean, so you're saying that that Jackson eliminated the death penalty and made it a non-capital crime.
In our position, that's true, Your Honor, although that's clearly in dispute between us and the government.
Okay. So if Jackson made it a non-capital crime, you're saying that the 1972 amendments are irrelevant?
No.
Because it had already been made into a non-capital crime.
It is our position that once Jackson came down, the five-year statute of limitations should be applied anyway. Although the panel decision, which is what we're here defending today, left aside that analysis because they went with the analysis that the change of the statute was clearer, was, and they applied that analysis. If you go with the panel decision, what Jackson did or didn't do really is irrelevant, with the exception of how it affected the savings clause. And it does become relevant in that analysis.
Ms. Nestor, are there any cases that have applied Section 109 to statutes of limitations?
In the case of Blue Seal Clause, a Blue Sea Line, they held that Savings Clause does not save discarded procedures. And in the Bridges case and the Obermeyer case, they did specifically state that 109 does not save statutes of limitations. They did apply that.
Going back to Griffin,
yes,
the distinction between substantive versus procedural, and we have to classify one way or the other. It seemed to me, and I'm not sure about this, but it seemed to me Landgraf addressed that, which was after Griffin. And the Supreme Court specifically said there's no special reason to think that all the diverse provisions of the Act must be treated uniformly talking about retroactivity. Why doesn't Landgraf supersede whatever Griffin said?
Well, Landgraf also acknowledged that it is about congressional intent, and also when Landgraf came down, that Landgraf's not inconsistent with applying a statute retroactively. And if you're suggesting it is, I'm a little confused.
No, I'm suggesting that it made our discussion of, well, you have to pick, is a statute procedural versus substantive? Seems to me the Supreme Court said a particular provision can be both, and you have to look at specific provisions within a statutory section. Some will be prospective and some will be retroactive.
And that's, right. And
by the boards on that.
And that also goes more to the intent analysis of what was intended by Congress. Clearly, I don't think anyone is going to get up here and dispute that the statute of limitations is a wholly procedural statute. I don't think anybody disputes that. I think the key question is what Judge Garza is getting to, which is the effect of the domino decision, basically. We submit that the domino started to fall when Jackson came down. And Jackson determined that there was no death penalty available anymore for that crime.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because, again, it seems to me that the court said you can't impose the death penalty. It does not seem to me that it changed the statute itself.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
And you know, the statute stays per congressional permission until it's amended. And isn't that the act that has to change the statute of limitation? I mean, that's the crux of this case, it seems to me.
Well, I'll start with the premise that we absolutely believe when Congress stepped in, there's no more issue anymore. It's clear.
That's true.
With respect to your question about Jackson, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree that that's what Jackson held. I believe that Jackson clearly did not just say you can't impose this. They said it's void on its face because it takes away your substantive right to elect to have a trial by jury.
Now, where did they say it's void on your face? I thought they wound it up and said it is unenforceable is the term they specifically used.
Your Honor, I believe they actually used the word void in Jackson, and if Your Honor will, when I'm on my break, I'll sit down and find that section of the case where it exactly said that. But it's very distinguishable from the Furman line of cases, what happened in Jackson. Jackson was in a severance and judicial excision, if you will, of language that on its face, not how it's applied like in Furman, where they were applying it unfairly. But on its face, it caused a defendant to choose between a jury trial or the death penalty. Because if a jury could be the only ones who return death, then in effect, if you chose a guilty plea, you could avoid death. So it put an unconstitutional chilling on your right to seek a jury trial. And what the court said is that's unconstitutional on its face. And they excised it and severed it and even made a finding in their ruling that they believed they could do that because the statute could stand alone and continue to operate with the rest of the statute once they did that.
Ms. Nestor, the effect of that presently, and I mean presently at the time of this indictment, 97? When was the indictment?
The indictment, 72, Your Honor.
The trial, I'm sorry.
The
indictment in this case was?
2007.
Hasn't the law changed, and does that affect any of the analysis? That is to say that a jury trial can only be the only vehicle by which you can constitutionally impose the death penalty. Does that change the analysis in those minute cases that will that have or will be tried, say 2007 on?
I'm not certain I totally understand your question, Your Honor.
In other words, what you're saying, you made two statements. You said that the amendment effectively changed the statute of limitation, but then you said that there was nothing to change because of Jackson. If Jackson is no longer the law, does the effect of Jackson for an indictment 2007 have the same force?
No, sir, because when the amendment actually happened in 72, that does change it. An ex post facto would prohibit you going back and erasing an ameliorative change.
I understand that. I completely understand that 72 have changed it. But does that change the analysis vis-a-vis 109? The present analysis, not back in 1972, but the present analysis, because Jackson is no longer the law. It's a question on both sides. I'm not sure what the answer is.
And it's not a simple question, but I do think, Your Honor, that the key to the savings clause analysis is the panel was dead on right the way they did it, that you first have to look at, you still have to make a decision about substance versus procedure. And we all are clear that in a statute of limitations is definitely procedural. So then you go to the Marrero test, and I think the question becomes, if the death penalty wasn't enforceable at the time that Congress made the change, then, in fact, there's nothing to save. And they picked a great quote in the panel decision. I think it was nothing to save.
Why isn't there something to change if it is still a capital crime and Jackson has not ever said that it is not a capital crime? Congress assumed that it could impose a death penalty on kidnapping, and they did attempt to do that and decided specifically not to do so. Where in this opinion, anywhere in Jackson, does it say that kidnapping is not a capital crime?
Well, Jackson doesn't say it, but the Fifth Circuit came back a few years in United States versus Hoyt and said it before the amendment came down. And in Hoyt, this court held that it was proper after Jackson, pre-amendment, but post-Jackson, to treat it as non-capital for all purposes. And that was again reiterated in the Kaiser case by this court after the amendment came down.
How do you define a capital offense?
Capital is punishable by death.
Right. And after Jackson, the Supreme Court simply said the procedure Congress adopted for enforcing this capital offense was defective under the Fifth and Sixth Amendment, but it didn't say it violated the Eighth Amendment, did it?
No, it didn't.
So do you think it remained a capital offense?
I don't, Your Honor, but again, under the panel analysis, it really doesn't matter if it did or not. I think it remained, it became non-capital because when they severed the language, they specifically said it wasn't just about you can change the procedure, it was this death penalty is unconstitutional, it is no longer, it does not exist,
it's void. But it was unconstitutional only because of due process and right to trial by jury, Fifth and Sixth, not the Eighth Amendment.
Right. That's correct. And we briefed that, Your Honor. It's our position that your Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial is a substantive right, that it is so combined with substantive and procedural that it is basically a substantive right. And we did provide the court with some authority for that.
Yeah, but that's essentially irrelevant to the argument. I mean, whether the Sixth Amendment is substantive or not, it cannot declare the death penalty, it cannot abolish the death penalty unless it is cruel and unusual under the Eighth Amendment.
Well, it abolished the death penalty as to that offense only, Your Honor, based on the language that
it did not abolish it. It made it unenforceable. That's what Congress, I mean, that's the way they end the case. We hold, or by holding this, it's unenforceable. Giving Congress the right, recognizing that it was a capital offense, Congress can come back and make the death penalty available if they do it right procedurally.
That's correct, and I think it's very compelling that Congress knew that and didn't do it and came back and instead made it officially non-capital, in which case we...
And why did they do that? Because of Furman, after a debate, nobody in Congress ever questioned that it was not a capital offense.
You mean prior to the amendment?
No, well, at any time until the amendment, and then at the amendment, they decided that they would make it term, that it would be punishable by a term of years instead of death.
That's correct.
Furman was decided before the 1972 amendments.
Yes, sir, very shortly before.
So at that time, regardless of whether you look at the offense, it says 1701 specific offense, or if you look at kidnapping as a general categorical type of offense, that offense was not punishable by death. You could not punish somebody for death.
That's correct.
So regardless of the change, it would seem to me that if the statute of limitations on its own face says punishable by death, and this offense was not punishable by death, what are we doing here?
That's my question, Your Honor.
Ms. Nestor, let me ask you this. Let me get back to Griffin, Judge Jolly's question.
Yes, sir.
The panel opinion said that the change converting a 1201 offense from a capital to a non-capital offense was not a substantive change, so because Jackson had already made the death penalty unenforceable. So because of that, this change, that is, conversion to non-capital, could be applied retroactively. Now, what I want to know is, why is that correct in view of the fact that you had all these substantive changes in that 72 amendment, particularly the new crimes that were created?
Well, that's, if I could break that question down, that you
I'd like a response to that question. I don't want to get over to the separate statute of limitations. I'd like you to answer that question first.
Okay, just to make sure I understand what you're asking me, Your Honor, you're asking me that if the substantive analysis in terms of the other things that were amended, you think you're asking me if that precludes the application of Griffin?
If it has a number of clearly substantive provisions in the 72 amendment,
yes, sir.
How can you apply the change from capital to non-capital retroactively?
Well, it's really not the change from capital to non-capital that you're applying
That's
retroactively.
That's a necessary premise to your argument.
What you're applying retroactively, Your Honor, is the effect that change has on the statute of limitations.
No, but you start off changing the very fact that this is not a capital offense, and you apply that retroactively. That's a necessary premise to your argument, it seems to me.
Well, and I stand by the panel's argument that effectively it's not a change because the death penalty wasn't in place at that time. So it can go retroactive. It's just codifying what the court had already done. But I think it's important to point out on Griffin, Your Honor, that there's a logic behind Griffin that doesn't exist in our case. Griffin involved a brand new statute that was being applied backwards only procedurally. Well, as they pointed out in Griffin, how can you apply the procedure backwards when there's no substance to go with it? How do you enforce something backwards when the crime itself isn't going backwards? There's nothing to enforce. In this case, that's wholly different from what we're doing. In Griffin,
wouldn't this case be like Griffin if somebody had attempted to apply the provision of the 72 provision criminalizing kidnapping of an embassy official? Backwards.
It might be, Your Honor. That'd be a closer
call.
You'd be
trying to take the criminal position backwards because of the inevitable consequence of those amendments that the limitations period has changed.
That might be a closer argument to Griffin, more along the line of what Griffin was doing. And also, I would point out to the court in Bernstein versus Sullivan, 10th Circuit, after Griffin, the 10th Circuit said, wait a minute, this Griffin analysis doesn't apply to a changed statute of limitations within this same statute. So they did the opposite of Griffin, and that still stands as good law, too, and we would encourage the court to follow that same reasoning that the Bernstein court called. I see my time has expired, and I will reserve the rest for
Thank
rebuttal.
You, ma'am. All right. Ms. Calderon.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Tova Calderon, and I am here on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, this case is about congressional intent. And in 1972, Congress did not intend to limit prosecution of anyone, including the defendant, who violated the kidnapping statute before 1972. And that is true no matter whether this court concludes, as it should, that the 1972 amendment is entirely substantive, or whether it concludes that the amendment is both substantive and procedural because of this indirect effect on the applicable statute of limitations. Without a doubt, the primary purpose of the 1972 amendment was to expand liability under the kidnapping statute. The amendment added three new crimes. It first made it illegal to kidnap anyone in the special maritime and territorial jurisdiction of the United States. It also outlawed kidnapping in the special aircraft jurisdiction of the United States. And finally, it made it a federal crime to kidnap anyone who was an official guest or foreign official in the United States, and that is in any jurisdiction and regardless of whether the victim had been transported in interstate commerce. The creation of these new crimes amounted to a substantive change in law under the kidnapping statute. At the same time Congress was expanding liability under the kidnapping statute, Congress also was seeking to strengthen the statute by fixing the problems the Supreme Court identified in its Jackson decision. And Jackson, as we all know now, weakened the kidnapping statute when it invalidated that statute's death penalty clause.
Why is SEAL?
She had reserved.
Oh, you reserved your time.
I did. I'm sorry. I'll be happy to answer your question.
No, that's fine. I'm sorry.
The red blinky light will tell you when you may ask.
Thank you. So Congress intended to strengthen the kidnapping statute with the 1972 amendment by restoring capital punishment for kidnapping. As a result, the amendment was originally introduced with new death penalty language that was drafted to comply with Jackson. But before Congress could approve the new death penalty language, Your Honors, the Supreme Court issued its decision in Furman. And as this court and other courts recognized, Furman effectively invalidated the federal death penalty as it existed at that time. To avoid the new death penalty provision from also being struck down, the sponsor of the bill decided to delete that language and replace it with a maximum sentence of life imprisonment. So in addition to creating new crimes, the 1972 amendment also changed the maximum statutory penalty, and I say statutory penalty, from a sentence of death to a term of life imprisonment. As a result of this change in penalty, kidnapping was reclassified as a non-capital crime. And because it became a non-capital crime, the time limit for prosecuting individuals who violated the amended statute also changed. It is clear, based on the legislative history, and this change in the limitations period was simply an indirect consequence of Congress's last-minute decision to drop the death penalty language in order to preserve the statute's constitutionality in light of Furman. But it was indeed a consequence, and it is plain that starting in 1972, kidnapping became a non-capital offense subject to a 5-year limitation on prosecution. There is absolutely no evidence, however, that Congress intended to shorten the limitations period for individuals, such as the defendant, who violated the statute before 1972 when kidnapping was still a capital crime. In fact, as I just discussed, the legislative history suggests just the opposite. Congress in 1972 was not concerned about the applicable statute of limitations for kidnapping. Rather, Congress was engaged in substantively expanding liability under the kidnapping statute. Congress's attempt to restore capital punishment for kidnapping and therefore strengthen the statute was entirely consistent with those other substantive changes. And because Congress was trying to expand and strengthen the statute, we can presume that Congress did not intend to make it easier for someone who committed a capital crime to escape prosecution by shortening the period of exposure to criminal liability. The defendant's argument that this indirect effect on the statute of limitations should apply retroactively to bar prosecution of his pre-amendment conduct is not only inconsistent with what Congress was trying to accomplish in 1972, but it contravenes basic rules of statutory interpretation. The first rule is that substantive legislation is presumed to apply prospectively, absent express congressional intent to the contrary. That presumption applies here because all of the amendment's changes were substantive. As I just said, the amendment's creation of new crimes and its change in the maximum statutory penalty were substantive changes. And nowhere did Congress express an intent to imply any of those changes retroactively. So under the first rule, the 1972 amendment is presumed to apply prospectively. The second rule is that this presumption applies with less force, or not at all, to legislation that is purely procedural. In other words, legislation that does not affect substantive rights, in some circumstances, may be applied to past conduct. But that is not the case here. The 1972 amendment was not a purely procedural amendment. And even if the amendment's indirect impact on the statute of limitations could be construed as a procedural change, the amendment also affected substantive rights because it created new crimes and changed the maximum penalty. There is simply no way to construe the amendment as purely procedural so as to apply it retroactively. Consistent with these rules, which the Court has always applied and continues to apply, this Court held that when legislation affects both substance and procedure, it must be applied prospectively in all of its applications unless Congress expresses a contrary intent. And that's what this Court held in Griffin versus the Department of Health and Human Services. In that case, this Court addressed what it described as a question of first impression, that is, how to apply a statute of mixed substantive and procedural character where, on the one hand, substantive legislation is to be given prospective application in the absence of congressional intent, and where, on the other hand, legislation may be given retroactive application. This Court resolved that question by holding that legislation that has both substantive and procedural aspects must be applied on a prospective basis only unless Congress has unequivocally expressed an intent to sever the amendment's substantive and procedural applications. Unlike the 1972 amendment, the statute at issue in Griffin was a predominantly procedural statute because it provided a change in forum for the adjudication of false Medicare and Medicaid claims. But the statute also contained a single substantive provision that expanded liability. HHS attempted to apply the procedural provisions retroactively to conduct that violated pre-existing law. It argued that retroactive application of only the procedural provisions and not the new liability provision was proper because it did not affect the petitioner's substantive rights. This Court rejected that argument. And this Court explained in that case that characterization of a statute does not depend on its particular application, but on its very nature. This Court went on to hold that the substantive liability provision so colored the nature of the act as to make the entire act substantive for retroactivity purposes. In other words, the act could not be applied partially on a retroactive basis because there was no evidence of congressional intent to do so. Your Honors, the defendant in this case asked this Court to do exactly what this Court told HHS it could not do in Griffin. The defendant is asking this Court to apply the procedural change affected by the 72 Amendment, that is the change in the applicable statute of limitations, to conduct that was illegal in 1964. But as this Court stated in Griffin, such interpretation creates congressional intent out of whole cloth and amounts to creative and imaginary statutory surgery. So no matter whether this Court construes the 1972 Amendment as an entirely substantive amendment, which is the proper way to construe it, or whether it construes it as having both substantive and procedural aspects, this court must conclude either way that the amendment does not apply retroactively for any purpose. And because the amendment does not apply retroactively, the law in effect at the time of the offense governs this case. That means that we apply the version of the kidnapping statute in effect in 1964 with its applicable statute of limitations. And applying that law in effect in 1964 does not frustrate policies of fairness or repose. Rather, it serves those policies because it does not disrupt the settled expectations regarding the legal consequences of the defendant's actions. In other words, the defendant in this case clearly was on notice that at the time he committed these crimes, he could be punished by death and prosecuted at any time in the future. The defendant certainly could not have foreseen that at some point after he violated the kidnapping statute, that Congress would amend it. Also, as this Court and the Supreme Court have made clear, even the liberal policy favoring repose cannot overcome the plain meaning of a statute expressing Congress's assessment of what constitutes a reasonable time for bringing prosecutions. In other words, we must look to the plain meaning of the kidnapping statute as it existed in 1964 to determine the applicable statute of limitations. And there is no question, Your Honor, that in 1964, Congress believed there should be no limitation on prosecuting individuals such as the defendant who kidnapped and harmed their victims. Although Congress in 1972 made a different assessment, that assessment did not apply retroactively for all the reasons I just stated. Your Honors, Congress's assessment at the time of the offense must prevail in this case. The defendant committed a capital crime as defined by Congress. And as Congress intended, he could be prosecuted at any time without limitation, including in 2007. For all of these reasons, the prosecution in this case was not time-barred. And I'm happy to take questions now.
Counsel, you've suggested, and perhaps you've cleared me up, after Furman and Jackson, under this statute, as it existed before and after, you could not, consistent with the Constitution, have someone punishable by death under this statute. You would agree with that?
Correct.
All right. So that would seem to answer it, except for your position, and may be well taken, that it doesn't make a difference what Jackson and Furman said prior to 72. What made the difference is whether it was a punishable by death at the time that he committed the offense.
Yeah.
What he perceived and what a defendant would know, how much time he'd be exposed to prosecution in terms of limitations. That's your answer to the question.
Yes.
Thank you.
Counsel, let me ask you about the Hoyt case. It is my understanding that in that case, the government argued that the Jackson decision itself rendered kidnapping non-capital where it had been capital. Are you familiar with that case and with the position taken by the government in that case?
I am familiar, Your Honor, and
how do you reconcile the government's position in that case with the argument you've now presented here before this court?
Following Jackson and Furman, courts of appeals uniformly
Furman hadn't even been decided.
Well, following Jackson then, starting with the Eighth Circuit in United States v. Coon, it was recognized that Jackson did not reclassify kidnapping as a non-capital crime for statute of limitations purposes. The issue in Hoyt was not statute of limitations. It was whether or not capital defendants are entitled to certain protections that are designed to protect them from the death penalty once the death penalty is off the table. And the court's conclusion in Hoyt that it was non-capital for all purposes, that has to be read in context. And that was for all of the purposes at issue in that case, which were the Rule 24B peremptory strike rule, which applies to capital defendants, and 18 U.S.C. 3432, which provides that the government must hand over a jury and witness list to capital defendants. And these are additional protections that Congress intended to protect the defendant who is facing a death sentence. This court, both before Furman and before Jackson.
Counsel, let me ask you. 3281 specifically says that the prosecution must be asserting a crime that is punishable by death.
Right. That is correct. And as you know, the government does not have to seek the death penalty in order for that statute of limitations to apply. So whether the death penalty is available constitutionally or not constitutionally, or whether the government decides to seek it or not seek it, or whether in Indian country, for example, a particular death penalty law is not enforceable by the Indian tribe, in any of those cases, the crime is still considered a capital crime for statute of limitations purposes, no matter whether the death penalty is actually available as an option.
Well, how can that be reconciled with the language of 3281? And an indictment may be, which is for an offense punishable by death, may be found at any time without limitation. It sounds to me like if you're not suing for the death penalty, that open-ended statute of limitation doesn't apply. Do you have a case anywhere that says that the language of 3281 requiring an offense punishable by death may be waived? If you do, you didn't cite it in your brief.
Yes, I'm sorry. I want to make sure I understand the question. You're asking if whether or not, if the government waives the death penalty, whether or not it's still subject to no limitation on prosecution? Is that?
Yes. I mean, the whole construct to me of the reason for 3281 is that you are seeking to enforce the death penalty.
Well, that's been
Congress said you could have more than 5 years.
That's been rejected by every single court of appeals to look at this question. They have concluded that that 3281
is... We're not interested in the court of appeals. We're interested in what the Supreme Court has said.
And in Jackson, you mean in the Jackson decision?
Yes.
Jackson...
It just is very difficult for me to understand...
Right.
When Jackson said the language that purports to create a death penalty is unconstitutional for whatever reason it gave, and furthermore, it says we're going to extract that language from the statute. At the end of the day, the Jackson opinion to me says, on its face, the kidnapping statute is no longer a death penalty statute. The language has been held unconstitutional, and the language has been excited, or whatever, however they make that phrase.
Well, the language was in the statute until Congress repealed it in 1972. The Jackson decision, in fact, recognized that Congress would not have wanted to discard the entire kidnapping statute or suddenly legalize kidnapping simply because the death penalty could no longer be imposed in its current form or in its form at that time. And the Supreme Court was very careful to uphold Congress's intent and keep kidnapping intact and keep the basic operation of the statute intact. The only thing that changed, and it says so at the very end of that Supreme Court decision, the only thing that changes after Jackson is that the death penalty clause is not enforceable. The language is in the statute. Technically, it's still punishable by death. The Eighth Circuit took a close look at this shortly after Jackson in United States v. Coon.
But Ms. Calderon, by your own admission, though, the defendant's not entitled to two attorneys. He's not entitled to 20 peremptory strikes. So the government is picking and choosing what aspects of capital versus non-capital apply.
Well, the government's not picking and choosing. These are statutes that are designed by Congress to protect a defendant who is actually facing a death sentence.
Well, how do you know that? The lower courts, the courts of appeals, have disagreed about that. The Watson case in the Fourth Circuit, the Ninth case in the Dufour disagreed over that.
The courts have uniformly agreed with respect to 18 U.S.C. 3432 that does not have to apply, and the Rule 24B. The only statute that there's been disagreement about is 18 U.S.C. 3005, which is the two-attorney rule.
That doesn't mean that the theory behind them is consistent, however.
They've applied the exact same analysis no matter what conclusion they reach. That is, you look at the statute or the rule to determine whether or not it is tied to the severity of the punishment, such as this rule.
And the statute of limitations.
Or tied to the serious nature of the offense.
But that's a judicial decree as to what serious and non-serious is.
No, it's
a lot of people would think that a kidnapping case, I assume the defendant in this case had two attorneys at trial with him, although they were both under the auspices of the public defender. No question it's a serious case.
There is no question it is a serious case, and that's why Congress authorized prosecution at any time without limitation. This goes to how Congress views
it. I understand that, but what I'm saying is seriousness, under your definition, is a judicial construct.
No. Under my definition, you look at Congress's intent and how Congress viewed the seriousness of the offense.
Ms. Calderon, you made the argument today and in your in-bank brief based on Griffin that all these new substantive crimes that were created in the 72 Amendment makes the entire amendment substantive and prevents applying any of it retroactively. You made that argument for the first time in your in-bank brief, or the government made that argument for the first time in the in-bank brief, and we ordinarily don't consider arguments made for the first time that are not made to the panel. And why should we consider that argument?
Since the district court, we have argued that the 1972 amendment is a substantive amendment.
You didn't make it to the panel.
We did not. We submitted Griffin to the panel within 48 hours after oral argument, but we did not.
You cited the case, but you didn't provide us that statute, and you didn't argue that those substantive crimes prevented retroactive application of any of the amendments.
Your Honor, in our opening brief, we said that this 1972 amendment was part, and we have cited the legislative history, made several substantive changes to the kidnapping statute, and that the repeal of the death penalty was just one of those other substantive changes. In fact, we are the ones who identified this issue as an issue of statutory interpretation. The defendant didn't raise this as an issue of statutory interpretation. The defendant cited the 72 amendment as further support for their argument that Jackson reclassified kidnapping as a non-capital crime. They spent one page out of their 72-page brief talking about the 1972 amendment. So we're the ones
who... I understand it from reading your brief, and I wasn't on the panel, of course. I read it for this, but it looked to me as if your brief going in to the panel only focused on 1201 A, the interstate kidnapping, and it didn't say, for all we know, the rest of it could have had to do with totally tangential issues.
Well, again, we were responding to the arguments that were presented to us at that time. Now, well, we have the benefit
Griffin
of the panel.
Was not Griffin and the full scope of the you know, new applications of the statute were just not evident to brought up to the panel at all.
I would like to say that the court does not need to rely on Griffin to agree with us, because the rules are the same either way. The rule is that substantive legislation must be applied prospectively absent express congressional intent to the contrary. And this is after Landgraf. After Landgraf, this court takes the exact same approach it took before Griffin and after Landgraf. First, you look to see whether or not Congress has prescribed the reach of the statute. You look to see whether or not Congress has expressed its intent regarding retroactivity. If it hasn't, then you look to see what the statute does, and you have to determine whether or not Congress is making a substantive change or a procedural change. When it's making a substantive change, even if it has some sort of indirect effect on some procedure for enforcing it, it is still considered to be applied prospectively only. And that's consistent with the approach the court has always taken. So there's no need to even rely on Griffin.
What about 109? Does your position depend on 109?
Well, it doesn't, because you don't get to 109 until after you determine whether or not the 72 amendment is substantive or procedural. And once you determine that it's substantive, then that can only apply going forward. We could not have indicted the defendant under the 1972 version of the kidnapping statute. I don't think anyone would think that we could. That was a substantive reenactment of the kidnapping statute that applied going forward. But that doesn't mean kidnapping was not illegal before 1972. It was, and there was a statute in effect that we could use to prosecute the defendant. And it defined
The only difference in the 1972 statute from a verbal standpoint, as opposed to the 19 earlier one, apart from the death penalty, is limitations.
No. The only difference between the 72 Act and the version in effect is the statute of limitations. That's absolutely not true. There was, first of all, it created the three new crimes, and second of all, it repealed the death penalty.
Well, we're talking about what this defendant could be indicted.
Right, but
about.
This court said this in Griffin,
that the argument that you faced before the panel was that you were looking at 1201A, I think it is, the one that refers to interstate
kidnapping. Even considering only that, it still had a substantive impact in this case, because Congress repealed the death penalty. That is a substantive statutory change.
I don't see any.
If the court in Jackson said the death penalty is out of the kidnapping statute, how does the action of Congress in simply reflecting that constitute a new substantive change?
Because Congress was trying to restore the death penalty. Congress was not trying
We don't count what Congress tried.
It's a substantive change.
Count what they did.
Right.
And what they did was eliminate the very language from the statute that the Supreme Court had said was unconstitutional and should be excised. Right?
Right.
Now, how does that constitute a new substantive decision on the part of Congress?
To determine whether a change in penalty is substantive or procedural, you compare the new statute with the previous statute. And clearly, a repeal of the death penalty is a substantive change. Now, your question about where does Jackson come in all of this,
you give no recognition whatsoever to the action that the Supreme Court took in Jackson. They said that very language is unconstitutional, unenforceable, and severable, and we sever it.
And under Daubert v. Florida, which is a Supreme Court case, you look at the new statute and you look at the old statute and you don't consider what was judicially... I'm sorry.
When was Daubert decided?
1977.
And what does that have to do with Congress's intention in 1972?
This is a case on statutory interpretation. Most of these cases came after 1972. This is guidance for the court on how to construe the statute as whether it was substantive or procedural. The defendant in Daubert was making a similar argument that there was a substantive change in penalty because the death penalty clause that was in effect at the time that he violated the statute had been subsequently held unconstitutional.
I want to make sure that I understood you correctly.
Sure.
And that is that the defendant in this case was indicted under the statute that was in effect at the time he committed the crime.
Yes.
And at the time that he committed the crime, it was punishable by death.
Yes.
And where does the government get the authority to indict somebody in 2007 under the terms of a statute 43 years earlier?
3281, Your Honor, provides that the defendant may be prosecuted at any time without limitation in the future.
No, it doesn't say he may be prosecuted. It says you may get an indictment found if it concerns an offense which is punishable by death.
And the crimes that we charged in this case were punishable by death at that time. This is a kidnapping in which the victims were not liberated unharmed.
After Jackson was decided, I would assume that if Seal had been prosecuted, would you say that we could still give him the death penalty because his crime occurred before Jackson?
No, we would not be seeking the death penalty. But just because you don't seek the death penalty doesn't mean it's not subject to 3281.
Pardon?
Just because we're not seeking the death penalty doesn't mean it's not subject to 3281. It's still technically a crime that is punishable by death as defined by Congress. The government would have to decide whether or not to seek the death penalty at the very beginning before even knowing when to indict someone if that were the rule. That doesn't even make sense. Before even arresting someone, you would have to decide whether or not you're seeking the death penalty, whether it's available or not.
The indictment against Seal had been brought in 69, the year after Jackson.
Yes.
At that time, that would have still, the whether or not there was a statute of limitations would have not been an issue in the case.
Correct.
And my point is, he could not be indicted for death penalty.
We would have still charged him with a crime that is punishable by death. Again, that doesn't mean we would have sought the death penalty. And after Jackson, obviously, we could not have sought the death penalty. But this is the courts have held that.
I lose you completely because you say that you can indict somebody for something that you don't really intend to prove against.
Punishable by death is a classification of a very serious crime as defined by Congress.
Okay.
It doesn't mean that the death penalty must be sought in every single death eligible case.
Tell me where the definition that you just said is Congress's definition can be found.
I would cite every single one of the Court of Appeals cases that deal with whether or not statutes of limitation.
The Court of Appeals cases are all long after.
No, they're not, Your Honor. No, they're not, Your Honor. We have Fourth Circuit cases, United States v. Ely, as recent as 2004. They're all within the last 10 years that we cite. United States v. Manning and Ely and Willenberg. All of these cases in our brief, cited in our opening brief and discussed at length in our opening brief and cited again in our en banc brief, have held uniformly that a crime that is punishable by death is subject to no limitation on prosecution pursuant to 3281, even if the death penalty may not be constitutionally sought. That is the rule that has been upheld by every single court of appeals and district court that has looked at this question.
And what does the Supreme Court say about that?
This issue has not been before the Supreme Court, Your Honor.
And so this may be a case we could get before the Supreme Court, huh?
Well, we'll go all the way if we have to.
Tell me again where Provenzano fits in this thing.
Well, Provenzano actually agrees with us on that issue.
Provenzano is an example of almost identical issues that are in this case. Is
Yes.
Your
and it
assessment?
Is, yes. And it is a district, Southern District Court of New York case from 1976. And the first part of Provenzano actually addresses your very question, and it concludes that after Jackson, kidnapping remained a capital crime for statute of limitations purposes.
Okay.
When it got to the 72 Amendment, it failed to engage in any sort of statutory interpretation.
Ms. Calderon.
Thank you.
Your time is up.
Thank you.
Ms. Nestor.
If I may, Judge Jolly, I'd like to immediately reference what I told you I'd look up when I sat down. Hoyt did not use the word void. Hoyt did say it was severable. And then where I got that word was we then cited the case of Parksdale.
Jackson. I thought you said Jackson.
I mean Jackson, Your Honor. I apologize. Jackson. And then we cited Parkdale v. U.S. for the theory that when a facially invalid statute can't be justified under any potential application, it's considered void under the law. So that's where I got the void. It was extrapolated from the Jackson case, but it was not actually in the Jackson case. Jackson only referred to it as severable. So I wanted to clarify that for the court. I would like to address what Judge DeMoss has been discussing with the government in that the clear language of the statute says punishable by death. It doesn't have exceptions or clarifications of that. When Ms. Calderon stands before the court and says every case that has considered this has decided that punishable by death doesn't necessarily mean you can enforce death, she's referring to a line of cases that all stemmed from the Furman v. Georgia decision. The Furman v. Georgia decision did not excise any language from any federal death penalty statute. It did not find the federal death penalty to be unconstitutional. The Furman v. Georgia case cited three state statutes and decided that as applied, it was unconstitutional. In the dissent, there was suggestion that it might have implications on future federal laws. Congress did not go back and change any language in any statute as a result of Furman v. Georgia. No, Congress did not go back and excise any language in any statute as a result of Furman v. Georgia. All of the cases that the government is relying on follows that line of cases that started with Furman and went to a case called United States versus Watson.
But those cases are nevertheless for the principle that a capital crime is a capital crime irrespective of whether the particular punishment may have been excised.
No, sir. I respectfully disagree with that. The line of cases says that when the language is still in the statute, Congress has never shown an intent to change the nature of the statute. They've never amended the language of the statute. If that's still on the books and we all agree that everyone wants it to be a capital case, then we can apply it as a capital case, even if the government is electing voluntarily, which all the cases after Furman v. Georgia is the government deciding, you know, we're not comfortable with the death penalty. We're just not going to go for it until we get it right. That was never ordered by a court. It was never ordered by a statute. It was the Department of Justice making a decision not to seek it. In those cases, the courts of appeals have held, we all still are treating these as capital cases. And then you got 1201 over here. 1201 has its own United States Supreme Court case that says it's facially invalid as a death penalty case. 1201 has the Hoyt case, this very circuit, that said it's non-capital for all purposes. 1201 has Provenzano, which has a dead-on, all fours, factual analysis with this case.
I'm looking at these cases. It says the limitation period depends on the capital nature of the crime.
Yes, sir.
And not on whether the death penalty is, in fact, available for the defendants in a particular case. And that is generally the holding of those cases.
And yes, sir, and that began with Furman and started, that analysis began on a case called United States versus Watson. And if you track all those cases all the way back to Watson, Watson in its body specifically accepted 1201 as a different situation. It distinguished itself from 1201, and all of these cases that the government cites flows out of Watson under this line of Furman cases.
Well, as I read Watson, what it says is that the offense is still a capital offense, and for that very reason, Watson refuses to deprive the defendant of two attorneys because it says Congress has not changed the law.
Exactly.
And we cannot fill a gap that Congress has not done.
Exactly. And they actually refer to Jackson and 1201 in the body of Watson and distinguish it and say that's different. They were dealing directly with a statute that they severed. Furman v. Georgia, if the government is correct in their finding of trying to say it's the same as the 1201 analysis, that would mean that they would have excised the language out of every statute that they had, every federal statute that had a death penalty. That didn't happen. Death penalty stayed on the books. The government went back to the drawing board and figured out how to fairly apply the death penalty. And guess what? They started applying it again as soon as they figured out how to do it. And nobody ever had an issue with that. That is not 1201. 1201 had a unique issue that denied a defendant a right to a jury trial, chilled his right to jury trial, and they severed it, cut it, and Congress said, you know what? You're right. And Congress codified what they did. It is not fall under these lines of these other cases.
Furman was an Eighth Amendment decision, wasn't it?
Furman was an Eighth Amendment decision, Your Honor, and the Jackson case was not an Eighth Amendment decision. That's exactly another distinction, Your Honor. That is correct. But I do want to point out that every case that has decided 1201, the status of 1201 since Jackson, there has not been a case yet that has said it should be treated as a capital crime. Not one in any state, circuit, or U.S. Supreme Court has said 1201 should be treated as capital since Jackson came down. And the line of the cases that the government's talking about dealt with the murder statute, the bank robbery statute, the arson statute, all of which were affected by Furman, none of which had the clear indication of the U.S. Supreme Court and Congress that we're not dealing with a capital crime anymore.
The cases you're citing or referring to saying none of them, did any of them fall between the date of Jackson in 68 and the congressional amendment in 72?
Yes, sir, Hoyt. The Fifth Circuit case of Hoyt did. And it
71.
Was, yes, it was in 71, and it specifically ruled that 1201 was non-capital for all purposes. And respectfully, it's amusing that the government's going to get up here and accusing a court of creating congressional intent out of whole cloth when they read a statement that said for all purposes and created out of whole cloth a parenthetical afterward that only applies to issues in this case. That's not what the case said. It said it's a non-capital case. And I see my time has expired. If there's no further questions, I appreciate the court's attention.
Well, thank you very much.